Hi everyone, welcome back to Walk with Bex and welcome to another live interview in the studio. Today I have with me Joe Brightman, who is an IFBB pro athlete, now classic physique. He's also a coach, physique coach, a very successful coach in the UK, and also YouTuber, Instagram, business owner, entrepreneur. Like, where else can I take that?
That stuff.
Well, firstly, a lot of stuff. You've achieved so much. And we just had this discussion off air that, you know, you've literally just turned 30 and you've achieved a huge amount in that time.
It's funny coming on podcasts. Firstly, thanks for having me on. Thanks for inviting me, of course. I actually, when I have these chats and people relate it back to me, I'm like, oh yeah, I've not done too badly. But I think as whatever we are, bodybuilders, entrepreneurs, you're already just looking for the next one, isn't it? So,
and that actually is leading me on to my first question. I want to know where it all started. Like, I want to know how you've got to where you are now, both in fitness and business. So I'm really curious. And that's what this podcast is all about. It's diving into people that I find really interesting, people that are successful. I really want to get into their mindset and understand how they think and how they've got to where they are. So let's start with fitness, because you're a big lad. Like, you literally are sitting in that chair right now. And I'm like, okay, he's getting bigger by the minute as I see him. And I remember probably the last time I saw you, you were definitely not as big as this. And obviously you're now moving from men's physique into classic physique as a pro. So let's take it all the way right back to where fitness started for you.
Gym started. So this is actually quite a funny story. I've probably told it before, but my mum, dad and stepdad are all like actually really into training.
Okay.
So my dad gave me like, my stepdad gave me an Arnold book, like the encyclopedia, not joking.
Are you serious?
Serious. They never competed. But they
at
always,
what age, can I ask?
Must have been like 17, 18.
Just put the book in front of you.
No, I don't know how that handover happened, but my stepdad had built a gym, like not in his house, but like on the side of his house. Nothing crazy, but had the bits you'd need to build a physique. Ironically, I never trained in it. So I used to go in there and basically just hated being told what to do. So I just didn't train, which is funny. So I had this, you know, amazing opportunity to have a head start and I didn't use it at all. Because I'd go in there and he'd be like, you're doing it wrong. I'd be like, all right, I'm not doing this. So I just didn't train. And then when I went to uni, I did start training. So I went to uni and I was like scrawny little guy. I was pretty late to hit puberty. So I was always pretty small through school. Not very good at sport, despite like loving sport. So I tried to get involved in them all, but I was always like sub or squad player, whatever. So
what sports did you play?
Football at school, and then moved into rugby. But again, I was just small and I wasn't quick. I wasn't like small and quick. I was just small and not quick. So not that effective. But I gave it my best, which is all we can do. So I always had like I wanted to be good at something. And then went to uni, started training, basically to just literally like get bigger. It was all it was. Like, I was a small kid, didn't want to be a small kid anymore. So playing rugby alongside that. So I got stuck into training and then just like enjoyed it. I literally just enjoyed the progression of it. Probably having like a bit of a routine as well. I think I struggled without routine, so it gave me something to go after. And then in third year of uni, I'd literally spent 3 years at uni like perma bulking, just trying to get big as possible.
What did you do to do that? How did you pile on?
I literally just ate. Like, that was what I did. I think the first big thing that I learned with training was like, once you start tracking your nutrition, you will actually start growing, lo and behold. So that was what I did. Training was always in a good spot. Like, I think some people just have the ability to take it there. Do you know what I mean? And go, not like, I'm not talking like JP levels of intensity at 18, but trying to just get stronger and knowing what failure feels like and, you know, getting to that level. So that was what it was really. And then literally once I started layering on nutrition, I found myself skyrocketing in terms of progression. That was all done naturally through uni. And then in third year, I met a guy called Fraser, who's one of my long-term friends, still like best friends with him now. And he, that kind of mantra of just like training with someone better than you, stronger than you. He was stronger than me, bigger than me, did more research than me, had all the supplements, all that stuff, probably useless, but that level of like really getting stuck into it. So he taught me a lot, and then had someone to train with. So we then like found a program, followed that. It was all very low rep stuff, like literally working in like 4 to 6 rep ranges, just trying to get stronger in that range. So we followed that through uni, and then he was like, oh, there's a competition in Birmingham. I was at uni in Coventry. Do you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, all right. Like,
and at what point, how old were you at this point?
So I would have been, we're going into third year, so I would have been 20. So my birthday's in July, as we just discussed. So I'm a late birthday in the academic year. So I would have been doing my dissertation, which by the way was in like English. I did English at uni, so nothing to do with anything I do now. So yeah, I did English at uni, was doing my dissertation and prepping for my first show. Don't know what I was thinking, but yeah, did that. And then sort of going back to the whole sport side of things, like I say, I was super engaged with sport, but never very good at sport.
So what do you think the difference is then between being engaged and successful at sport compared to bodybuilding? What was it about bodybuilding that you were able to really get into and find that connection where you were like, okay, this is something I can get really good at?
It was because I was good at it that I found a connection at it.
But why were you good at it? Because you said like you were working towards progressive overload very early on and getting strong, and then obviously had your training partner and friend Frazier. Was it that competitive element together? Was it?
That's a good question. I literally think it was just having something to go and work at week in, week out. I can't give like a super deep answer on it, but it was something that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Probably something that maybe I was seeing some success at. Mm. So maybe when I started realizing I was getting
stronger. You can see progress very quickly in a logbook.
Yeah. I think I was logging my training as well. I didn't like notes on my phone or whatever, but it would have been that. And then also just actually seeing your body change, like, you know what it's like, if you're decent, even if you're not decent at it for the first 6 months, if you're consistent, you will see progress.
Yeah.
So if you actually push intensity as well, and you nail some very basic stuff about maybe just eating in a surplus and, you know, eating some protein and getting some okay sleep, like, you will see that progress, especially if you have some good genetics or some half good genetics. Obviously, I'd like to think I do, given where we've taken it. So obviously that all combined led to some level of early success. And then
deciding to compete during your final year at uni.
Exactly. And I think for the first year, I sort of trained by myself. In that second year, I was just at a uni gym in the first year. And then the second year, we went to Future Fitness in Coventry, which back then was amazing. So we'd go there, and I don't know how many listeners will even know these names, but back then there was a few of the like OG Gymshark guys who were sponsored by Gymshark when it was like Matt August days, training in this little gym. We were like in their vicinity. So for us, that was insane. Like, I would look at those guys and their physiques and be like, I'm never going to get there. Like, I would just like look at these, they're like gods, genuinely. Mm-hmm. And then as time went on, obviously just being exposed to those guys over and over again, and we were just getting on with our training. And like I said, it just, the body was changing. And then obviously going into a prep is then a time when you get to pull it all off and really see like what improvements you've made.
Was that your first experience of then dieting?
Yes, never dieted before. Like I said, I was on that literal perma bulk for like 3 years. Like, I put on like 5 stone naturally, which is crazy across like a 3 year period. But that's what can happen. So I think I went from like 80 kilos when I went to uni, maybe even less than that, to 100. The heaviest I got at uni was 100 kilos. And I was like, I'm big now. You know.
And what are you now, just for reference?
128 or something. So a bit bigger than that. But yeah, that was literally it. Like, for me, I think it was just, I like found the home in the sport of bodybuilding. And then I guess the final piece of that like success puzzle was I got second in that first show. And there was like 70 competitors in this show. Mm. And I was up against people that I think had been doing it for much longer than me, you know, had more muscle than me, were maybe better conditioned than me. But for whatever reason, I got chosen, which I guess is going to come down to like just aesthetically pleasing physique at that time. I fit the criteria, whatever it was. You know, it wasn't a bodybuilding competition. It was like a fitness model type competition. So like that went well. And then that really was like literally the rest is history. I was like, oh my God, I've spent all my life trying to be good at something, failing. And now I found this and I'm actually, by the looks of things, decent at it. So that was where it started, really. And I remember feeling like so proud of myself. I remember my family were there and they felt proud of me. So that was really nice.
So you had the support of your family the whole way through, obviously.
Literally, yeah. From like, I've never had to have a challenging conversation with them about bodybuilding or about steroids or about any of like, it's been full support. I think they know that. I'd like to think they know, you know, if they challenge me on it, I'd like to think I'd give them a good answer, enough
An
to justify
answer.
What I'm doing. So I think they know what I'm doing. And I mean, probably the bit I missed out about my dad and stepdad is that they also took anabolics when they were like younger, and they probably did it much worse than I did, you know, with no rhyme or reason, no blood work, no nothing. So I don't really think they had a leg to stand on, even if they did turn around and say you're being an idiot. So yeah, there was, you know, all that came into it. And I think they could probably for the first time were relieved that I stuck to something and I clearly like was committed to it. And I'm actually all right now.
He's like, shall I get you a towel?
Towel would be great. I should have brought a towel. Yeah. Nice one, thanks. That would be enough.
I'll have to decide how I'm going to edit this now. It's going to be fun.
Just keep it in.
I might just keep it in.
This is what you got.
That's what happens when you're a perma bulk.
That's literally it. I mean, that happens even... Actually, no, it doesn't.
Don't, no. So, are you all right now? Yeah. We've cooled you down a little bit.
Just for the viewers, if they didn't see that, I was sweating as per normal.
And how long have you been in Dubai?
2 weeks and a bit. I did go home at the weekend, though. I felt 8 degrees.
Yeah.
So I was able to, like...
You haven't quite adjusted since coming back.
Not quite.
Bless you. But we were talking about, so you never really had any challenging conversations with your family. They were all really supportive of your journey.
Yeah.
And still to this day probably are.
Yeah, I think as time's gone on, we'll probably get into this a bit more later. Like, I think now, because like it gets to that point when you're in off season, or, you know, there's a bit of a joke about when you get so shredded, like your mum's a bit worried.
Yeah. Like,
it gets to that point. And I think they've seen probably the last two preps, I wasn't particularly happy, didn't feel like a very nice person, I think.
Mm.
So then, you know, some challenging conversations come. But yeah, back then it was, by and large, it was healthy. I was natural. I was, you know, maybe miserable at times because I was dieting, but it's kind of part of the process. I guess there's a bit of bias from them, or at least from my dad and stepdad anyway, because they're like actually interested in bodybuilding. But I think, as a bit of a running joke when I was a kid, I would like say to mum and dad, could you take me to here to go try this sport or play this sport? And I'd stick to it for like 4 weeks and then can it. So they're probably just happy to see me like committed to something and have a bit of direction. That's what it gave me, really. That's what bodybuilding gave me.
And it's led into so many other things now, and it's completely 100%. Changed your life.
Yeah.
You know, you're at uni studying English.
Yeah.
You're not doing a job that's with English.
Nothing to do with it. And I think, yeah, even... not only sport-wise, but yeah, like education, career, all that stuff as a kid, very much like under-potentialized, like quite short attention. But, you know, school was all right, I enjoyed it, but the report was always like, you know, Joe could do better if he, you know, paid attention.
If he applied himself.
Yeah, how many kids hear that? Like, so...
It basically, you found your passion, something that you could do really well, and it's now turned into your career and something you can see yourself doing long-term.
Yeah, like, and after that show, I was like, I'm going to do this again because it felt good and I was good at it. And then, yeah, that led into UKBFF, you know, NPC, IFBB, whatever. And then, yeah, that's the...
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about your pro card. Let's talk about that journey, because that was an interesting one.
That was a big one.
Yeah. And I think anyone that's watching that knows you would have probably followed a lot of that, because you are very active on social media, Instagram, YouTube. Mm. So let's go back to that prep.
Yeah, that was crazy. That, to this, I mean, again, something I've probably repeated a few times, but to this day, I think, and I don't know if there'll be a bigger accomplishment for me than that, which sounds, I think, so strange, but I mean, maybe there will, hopefully there will. But for me, that was, and still is to this day, like just the
pinnacle.
Just like, yeah, like, I don't even feel like I'm really like chasing to get that back. I'm just appreciative of it. Like, it was amazing. The way I've described it is, I think maybe growing up or whatever, not even growing up, but as you get older, you have some things, some really, really big things that seem so far away that you'd love to achieve. And you're like, oh, I don't know if this ever happened, but I'm going to commit myself to it and try and make it happen. And for a lot of people, it's probably like, I don't know, maybe something material, maybe a car or a watch or even a family, or, you know, having kids and buying their first house, all that stuff. And as I got deeper and deeper into bodybuilding, it's literally like, I want that pro card. And I would have done anything to get it, which is, I think, why I got it at the end of the day. Like, it, you know, there was never a chink in my armor when it came to that journey. But yeah, to get that, and I don't know how many people, a lot of the people I see going for their pro cards now, like seriously, are probably coaches on, you know, that's their job and they can really dedicate their whole life to it. I had like a 9-to-5, you know, it was just not that simple for me. But like I said, I would have done anything to get it. So I made it happen. And I think when I do reflect back on what I did to make that happen, then yeah, like, it is the pinnacle.
Tell us a little bit about that. So in the 9-to-5, what were you doing at the time then whilst you were prepping for something that was such a huge goal for you?
So even, you know, the 2 years prior to that, because I competed the year before and didn't turn pro. So I did two shows that year and then came back for, I think I did another four the second year. I was working at John Lewis, like head office in London. So my typical day would... It wasn't, you know, it's no crazy job. It was like e-commerce stuff. I was making a website look good so that people would buy it. The whole role was driving conversion on the website, which is basically how many people can you get to come on and actually leave with, you know, having bought something.
Maybe so, why you're so good at business.
Maybe, well, or maybe not, but like not, you know, not particularly inspiring. I remember lots of days at that job thinking like, what am I really doing? Like, these people, you know, people are saving lives out there and we're trying to make a website look nice so we can sell some jumpers. I just, that, and people will find purpose in that job and they'll find purpose in lots of jobs. But for me, I couldn't, it wasn't important to me. But like anything in life, like I tried to do my best and I wanted to progress. And obviously I was living in London, super expensive. So I needed to progress to earn more money because it was pretty uncomfortable otherwise. So I was doing that alongside. So I was trying to progress that role. I wasn't, you know, wasting my time there. I wasn't vacant. Like I had to put the effort in because, you know, ultimately you're there 37 hours a week. So you might as well, you know, try and be good at it or do your best at it and try and progress. So I did that. But I guess in the depths of prep, what that looked like was, I think I calculated after prep because I probably couldn't bear to look at it on prep, but something like 1400 calories a day, an hour of cardio a day, which would get done pre-work. I'd then go to work. On my lunch break, I'd walk just like around London, Victoria to get my steps in. I think I had 14,000 steps to hit. And then after work, I'd train. That would take, as it does us all, an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then I'd commute home, make my meals for the next day, do it again. And not only make my meals, but make my meals for the night, for the next day, pack my bag.
Make sure everyone's ready for the gym the next day.
Have it all laid out and then to get up at 5 and to go and do it again for 5 days straight. And then the weekend would come and I'd get a bit of a break. But I actually found the weekends a bit harder. I think that's probably something a lot of people can relate to. Like that structure's then gone.
Yeah.
Your day's not filled with emails or people, and suddenly if you want, you could just go and eat. So I had to find stuff to do that day as well. But that was how that looked.
1400 calories a day for a man of your size, it's tough. Did you struggle with dieting and food cravings, things like that?
100%. I actually think I struggled the least that prep though, out of all of them.
Okay.
Which is weird. I don't know if that is a combination of just how badly I wanted it, the fact that I was on a meal plan and not macros, I think, and literally a meal plan that was like set for me. I was with like Rob back then, LRF, and it was super old school stuff, man. It's like eggs, steak for breakfast. Like meal one was like chicken and like literally 25 grams of rice, I think, at one point.
Yeah.
I was like, what? What's the point? Rice, like, yeah. So it was very bland, and I did what I could to spice it up. But you know, all credit to Rob, and I think we actually spoke about this the other day in the gym, like. That level of like militancy, when you know, I think in my head, logic is a big thing for me, right? So when something doesn't make sense to me, I don't feel like I've got buy-in, but Rob almost like beat the sense out of me in certain occasions. Like there's one, I remember one time where I was like, can I go to Nando's this weekend with my friends and I'll literally get a butterfly chicken breast and like broccoli or whatever was in them. And he was like, no, you're on prep, like you don't know what's in it. And I was just like, fucking hell, come on, man. But like, to be fair to him, like that all or nothing enabled me to like, you know, do those things and reach those levels. So I think there is a place for that sort of stuff at times. I think I've often joked like bodybuilders are often good at following a plan because like they don't think beyond the plan.
No.
And then if you actually don't, if your thought stops there at the whatever your coach has set you, like you can only do that, so you can't really go far wrong. It's when you start, you know, I say it with clients now, like one of my clients the other day sent me his basket with a load of those like bare naked noodles in. He's on a fat loss phase and I'm like, just don't do it. Like, just don't cut corners. So I've learned a lot of lessons because I think that prep there were no corners cut. And as I got maybe smarter and better at the process myself, I've applied some of that stuff, but I think it leaves gaps.
I wanted to talk about that because you're very renowned for that, having obviously that very strict meal plan prep with Rob, but then moving to a macro based approach. And I actually wanted to ask you about that, like what that did for you in your other preps and your other kind of phases, and what that did for you, not only in how your physique changed across the course of a prep, but also what it did for you mentally with food. I'm curious.
Yeah, like mentally is the big one. And I think after that prep, I would always recommend people go, always, most of the time, and I still do it myself, with like, I go for macros for off season because I like going out for food and I'm not gonna like take that away from myself. I don't wanna actually eat cream rice 365 days a year, to be quite honest. I need that flexibility to actually enjoy, you know, life. And I think that's fine. Like, I think if we look at arguably the greatest full time, like Sebum, like he lives a life very much like that. You could argue he can get away with it because he's absolutely like, you know, blessed in genetics. But for me, like, I don't think I'd be happy doing it the true, you know, the robot way, if you like. So,
and also you have to have a degree of life balance. Like when you're on prep, it is all or nothing. In most cases, that is the most successful prep because there are a few variables.
Yeah.
And when there are a few variables, that's when changes happen. And when you change those variables, that's when you see more progress because you've got less to play with and nothing that's muddying the water.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're in an off season and you're in an improvement phase, if you don't have that flexibility, you feel like you're on prep 24/7.
But then also I totally see the argument for being militant on off season as well. Like I had a conversation again today with a client about, like, he was sort of saying, we've just prepped together, he was saying, oh, I think in previous off seasons I've not been as militant, and like, yeah, that is where the progress happens. So there is 100%
but again, it's a percentage of it. Like, yeah, there's a degree of, like, I'm on my meal plan, you know, majority of the time, 80%, and then 20% I'm having a meal off plan once a week, and then there's, I'm on off season, I'm gonna have a muffin every pre-workout, yeah, or be a dickhead with food. There's, yes, a difference.
Exactly. But in terms of what I think meal plan versus macros did for me, like physically and mentally, I've actually, when I look back, I said this to, you know, Babs, I had a conversation with Babs at the weekend.
Very good friends with
Babs.
Yeah,
we were speaking about what our kind of goals are competitively next week, or maybe I won't say it to ruin it, but like, I'm sure that's a question.
She was with you in Birmingham, wasn't she?
Yeah. But like, I haven't looked back at stage pictures since I won my pro card in that season and been like 100% happy.
Okay.
That's the last time. So that was 4 years ago. I've competed. I've done two seasons since then. And only once have I looked back and gone, like, you know, looked back at stage pictures and gone, yeah, like, that was it. We nailed it. I looked my absolute best. So, you know, there's argument there for, was, you know, what was that? Was that the meal plan? Was that the fact that other, like, anabolics have been used since then? What is it? Is it a training? Who knows? But, yeah, the macro or IFYM sort of style. It's funny because quite often I will start prep like that because I've come from off season being a bit more relaxed. But as I get into it, like I remember saying to Cal last year, I was like, I need a meal plan now. Like, I need to go to, like, to cancel out all this stuff. But even then, unless someone sits me down and tells me exactly what to eat, I think I will still find ways to be like, justify it to myself. And the bottom line is, like, I am just cheating myself, and so is everyone else.
And would you say then that you have a difficult relationship with food?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's the thing I struggle with most, I think, in bodybuilding. And again, I think, like, over the last couple of years, so the last 2 years competing have been the only time, again, since turning pro that I've competed year on year. Because I think for me, I need time off, like I need a break. I need time to make improvements, you know, more than anything, but like, I need some time to not be in this like hyper restrictive mode. I enjoy off season. Like, people get asked that question all the time, prep and off season. For me, it's like off season 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
I prefer how I feel. I prefer like what life looks like. I prefer who I am as a person. Like, for me, prep does need to be a smaller percentage of my life because I don't think it is overly beneficial.
And would you prefer a shorter prep to a longer prep? Have you had different ones? With that, considering food being something that could be a trigger for you, would you rather be like in and out on a prep, a shorter one?
Yeah,
or do you think it all depends on how far you've taken your off season?
I probably would again, like that. So that pro card prep was like, we actually did, this is crazy. I think we actually did. We went from like off season to prep in 8 weeks. As in, sorry, off season to like first competition in 8 weeks. And I was men's physique peeled for that first show. Like, I still think I should have won that show. I've said that so many times. I came second, but I still think I should have won it. So like, we did it and it's possible. Like, it was a shotgun prep, as you say. And then since then, we've been a bit longer. I think probably what's happened in the more recent ones is that I definitely got leaner, to be fair. There's no, I don't think there's any argument about it. Like, every prep has been leaner. Like, last year, obviously, I had to do classic, I had to have my glutes in and my hamstrings in. The year before that was my first men's physique pro prep. I was definitely leaner. But I've just never looked back on the stage pictures and gone, yeah, that was it. Like, that was me at my absolute best.
So you've never really been happy with your physique?
Not at pro level. Yeah. I don't feel like I've hit my potential in the pro leagues at any point.
Okay.
Which I guess is exciting in some way.
It's the comeback.
Yeah.
So let's take a different angle and let's come back into kind of social media, your business. When did that all really kind of kick off? Would you say that was during that first prep for your pro card you kind of saw your social media develop and then you moved into coaching?
No, so actually that very first prep, I didn't have a fitness account.
Social media presence at all.
I had like a personal account, which is like me on nights out with my mates, like that was it. So yeah, in that first uni prep there was nothing, which is funny because in the gym next to me quite often was like Ryan Terry, and so he was obviously doing a good job at that. It was actually after that prayer that someone said to me, he was a photographer, he said to me, you should start an Instagram. Like, why are you not documenting this journey? And I was like, oh yeah, like, all right, I'll do it. So I started then. And it was very slow as it is. I think I often look back on the whole Instagram journey and I think I probably missed that. You know, that like first wave of influencers where it was like, I don't know, I'm thinking of like Sean Stafford, those sort of, that group of people, Ross Dickerson, who are now just sort of posting like memes quite often. But like, it was, I'd missed that. So it wasn't so
where
easy.
Where hashtags were actually working.
So it wasn't so easy just to go viral back then. I feel like that's kind of coming back around now, which is a bit weird with like reels and stuff, but that's a different conversation. But yeah, so I started posting after that, and growth was slow, like really, really slow. I can't remember when I hit my first like 1,000, but I distinctly remember the first, I think when I was doing my first run at pro qualifiers, I maybe had like 4,000 or 5,000. So it was really not that many. By the time the next year, when I was then doing the second lot of pro qualifiers, I think I hit 10K just after I turned pro, or just before. I think it was just
and
before.
And were you YouTubing at the time?
A little bit, like very inconsistently. Never used a videographer. It was always like self-filmed. I think that was a super slow process. I still wouldn't call myself a YouTuber either. Like, I think, again, I'm confused that I've got 15,000 followers, to be honest, on there. Because
do you prefer to vlog yourself, or do you prefer to have a video?
I prefer to do it myself. Mm. It's just the effort of then editing it. And the problem is with being friends with like Tom, TM Cycles, for example, when I look at his content and it's so good, I want my self-vlogs to look like that, and they're never going to. I've actually learned to let go of that a bit more, which is good.
But you're self-taught. You've learned it all yourself, how to
totally
do it.
Yeah, self-taught. Like, I've not even done any courses or anything. And I wouldn't say my videos are good, by the way, but like, I pick things up, I guess. But in terms of like producing content, yeah, I prefer to be self, like, I prefer to film. I think the people that
follow me prefer it
so much as well. But it's just so much effort, like, to film. I think, well, not effort, but time consuming, you know, once you get the content. And then I had this like mental block where if I filmed one video, I almost can't start filming the next, because that one's there and I'll forget about it, and then it's just wasted, and I hate doing that. So that's where I'm at with that. But I think I've found that at the moment it's a bit of a blend. Like, you kind of have to have, or I think it's useful to have some of those filmed ones by a professional, because it looks better. It might not be as authentic and raw, but that's where I find my ability to actually deliver value rather than
just, and also be consistent. Like, YouTube reward you for consistency.
Exactly.
So your videos get more views the more frequently you post, and I've learned that as well. And I think when you're on a prep and you're so laser focused on something, it's almost easier to add that extra workload, because it just fits into your schedule, and you're filming stuff constantly and you've got a schedule to post. I find it easier to vlog when I'm on a prep than I do now. Like, it's taken me a month to do another vlog for my YouTube with an off-season update. Do you know what I mean? So I understand that. And I think, again, you've got to go with what your audience wants. Your audience want value. So if that means someone else is filming for you and it means the content's coming out more regularly, then that's great. And then as long as you're picking up the camera in between and doing other bits that connect with your audience.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had a videographer, I think I'd probably lose a ton of subscribers because I think people like the fact that I do that and I talk to the camera. Yeah. I think
when you're looking at that, it's like you need to be looking at the composition of your views or subscribers as well. Like, my girlfriend keeps banging on at me, I need to put on my inquiry form, like, where did you find me? Because I bet a lot of them actually are through YouTube.
Yeah.
And when people do say it 100%. Just without, you know, spontaneously, without me asking them, a lot of them is like, oh, I found your YouTube, or I liked a video. And I was like, okay, that makes a bit more sense. It gives you a bit more like, oh, maybe it is, you know, working, if you like.
And what you got to remember is it's there forever. So like, you could post those, they're probably watching your prep series and things like that from ages ago, and it builds that relationship without you realizing.
Yeah. To be honest, like, vlogging that pro car prep and still having that video there is like one of the best things I've ever done, because to have
I can't watch my one back, I cry.
Yeah, it's amazing. And yeah, the editing probably was shit, but it doesn't really matter, because it was like raw and authentic, and like, I edited it, and that's a nice thing to have done. But yeah, I definitely prefer doing it myself. That's not to say I don't like, I think working with videographers, actually, if you get like, it's quite a hard thing to perfect, and it takes a lot of investment, I think, to get it right, and it also probably takes quite a lot of time. And also, which is probably the hardest thing, you need to find the right person. So for me, the best period of like working with a videographer would have been last prep, when we went out to America, and like Josh had Andy Hillux come, and Loki came with me.
Yeah.
That was amazing, because then it was raw and authentic. Like, he was there just to pick the camera up. You know, he could put it in my face when I woke up if you wanted it. It's not this scene that I've had to do myself and me getting out of bed. It is like, it is legit and it is raw. So that is the perfect balance. But obviously, to have someone like that, you literally have to have someone living with you. It's not easy to find someone,
and it's an investment
to do that.
It's a lot of money to do it as well.
So much, yeah, it is. But I think a mix is good. Yeah. Like, if I'm doing like reels or whatever, and I mean, delivering actual educational value, then yeah, I think having a videographer is there better. It just looks.
And you manage your whole Instagram yourself?
Yes. Yeah. another challenge.
Yeah, and you put out a lot of good content there, and also a lot of inspiring stuff for new kids on the block that are trying to do what you're doing as well, which I think is good. It's very value-based and, you know, informative. So would you say then from that 10K, it then just climbed?
So it's funny, I can actually remember when I got 20K, because that was after my... That was when I was on the way to, yeah, between turning pro and New York pro. I was literally in the cab in Dubai because there was quarantine, I don't know if you remember. We weren't allowed to go from the UK to the US. So I was in Dubai for 2 weeks and then flew from Dubai to the US. And in the cab early morning going to the US, I hit 20K and I was like, oh, sick, I'm 20K. So yeah, I think it was after that. And then now it's on like 34. So it's pretty slow growth, really, to be honest. Like, I've seen people go from like 6K to 100K in the last year.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean with the whole viral thing at the moment. I'm just obviously waiting for my time. It's going to come. But yeah, that's where I'm at with that. Yeah, it's all
But what that's done for you is not just as a bodybuilder increased your presence online, but it's also contributed massively to your business.
Yeah, for sure.
So when did that all kind of come into play? When did you start moving away from John Lewis and getting into coaching?
I think so. Coaching started when I think it was like 2017. So it's like 6 years, like a pretty long slog. So that would have been before trying to do my first pro qualifier prep. So like before I went assisted, anything like that, it was back then. So but then let's say I had, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 followers, maybe something like that. And I initially just started coaching people who I thought, well, friends initially. And it was so cheap, like £45 a month, I think I did initially. Like, that's crazy.
It's like less than a PT session.
Yeah, and that was just for like, that was literally a few friends or like, I think one guy that I knew from uni. And then like, I remember getting my first like client who didn't know me personally. That was quite cool. Because I was like, oh, people are actually listening. And that, I guess that kind of gave me belief that actually people were just interested in you as a person. Because there was definitely better coaches, way better coaches than me back then. And definitely people with bigger followings. So it was like, but he chose to work with me. So yeah. I was like, oh, there's something in this. So I kind of carried that on. Not really sure how the rest of them came about. I guess, again, similar to him, like had followed my journey, probably maybe interested in the 9 to 5 and pro card thing. Not really sure. But yeah, that was when it started, so 2017. And then it wasn't until in 2019, I set up a limited company. Mm-hmm. That was after the time, just after I turned pro. I turned pro in May 2019. In July, I like incorporated my company because I think I had just before I turned pro, it must have been like 10 clients. I literally remember getting on my phone after I got my pro card and there was like a load of inquiries in there, which always makes me laugh, like as if that made me like a bad coach, but there you go.
I think prep does that for a business.
Oh, for sure.
100%.
But that should have been like a slow growth rather than like, oh, he's got his pro card, let me inquire. Yeah. But that's how it worked. So yeah, no complaints about that. But yeah, after that, then I was like, okay, I think I need to like make this official. And then yeah, that was the birth of it, really. In terms of moving away from John Lewis, that wasn't until lockdown. So lockdown came around and I was like, oh, right, I'm going to lose all my clients. And then actually there was a time when people needed one the most because they had more time, no idea what to do because there was no gyms all of a sudden. And I didn't have any idea what to do as a coach either because I'd never coached someone living at home.
Yeah.
So I had to very quickly learn and make sure all my clients were looked after. But then also I think for me through lockdown, I was just putting out useful content for people. Like I was doing these stupid movements that everyone else is doing, but like trying to be really open and sharing that whole journey, which hopefully, you know, people found useful. And then, yeah, from there, that was crazy. Like lockdown from the start, whenever we went in, I think it was like March 2020.
Yeah.
By July, I'd like tripled my client base. Mm-hmm. And I'd just bought a house and I was like, okay, I need a certain amount of money to pay the mortgage or, you know, like be secure. And I was like, if I get to that number, I'm going to hand my notice in. And then that's what I did. So that was insane.
Yeah,
absolutely insane. It was, I say it to this day, like that was the best, lockdown was the best thing that happened to me.
Agreed. And I think it was a time when a lot of coaches, it was either sink or swim.
Yeah, 100%.
And for a lot of PTs, it was, are you going to go back to PTing or are you going to actually get on the online coaching now if you've got the knowledge to be able to do it? And it's weird that you say that because I was the same and Darren was the same. I remember when lockdown hit, everyone was freaking out and I was like, this is the perfect time for us to actually capitalize on this and support people. And the more you can support people and offer free information, the more that's going to benefit your business six months down the line, a year down the line, because people are going to remember the content you put out and how you helped them. Because so many people struggled, you know, and it's a way that you can support your clients as well. So from lockdown onwards, then it was no more John Lewis. You had notice when you reached that kind of cap of numbers.
Yeah.
And then what I want to talk about, and you'll understand this the same as I will as a coach, is keeping that going, that sustainability with a business, because there's a certain degree of business acumen that's needed, but also self-belief to know that, okay, I'm not going to have to go back to John Lewis. Because I remember when I quit teaching, I was a teacher for 10 years. And I remember when I told my mum I was online coaching permanently, now I've quit my job, it was, well, you've got a teaching degree and a master's, you can always go back to that when that doesn't work out. So talk me through your mindset of going into this and thinking it's going to work and this is going to be my long-term thing.
That for me was just a calculated risk that I was like willing to take. And I still think even to this day, like I've said this before, I actually don't want to be traveling to bodybuilding shows in 5, 6, 7 years. I don't want to be going to shows when I'm 40, still coaching people to stage. Like I'm hoping it's gone way beyond that by then. Mm-hmm. But I was like, right, I think I can do well enough in whatever it is, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, let's say 10 year stint. Like I think I can do well enough in that period of time to hopefully then move on to something else. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, like, I'm not trying to be the next Hanny Rambod. Like I don't still want to be doing that. So for me, that was a calculated risk. But it was one that was worth taking. Like I'm really lucky with my like support from a family perspective. Like if it did all go to shit, I'm lucky enough to say I could just go home. Mm-hmm. And if I had to start again, I could start again. Like which is very fortunate of me, of course. Like other people will have that much more difficult, but I guess, you know, the one thing I always tell myself whenever I have that feeling is like, well, I've done it to this point, so can't I just keep doing it?
Yeah.
And what's going to stop me? Like, it's only going to be me that's going to stop me. Like nothing's going to come along and like, you know, remove my ability to coach. As long as I keep getting better, like mm-hmm. it's going to be fine. And then, you know, when business dips or whatever, I'm like, well, I've had a month like that before, so I can't do it again.
Yeah.
My followers aren't going down. Like,
no.
You know, nothing is becoming less relevant necessarily. Yeah, there's more competition, but like I just have to keep getting better.
Yeah.
And it is just that belief of like looking back. I think the longer you do it, the more sure you should be of yourself. I've actually not worried for a long time about like, oh, like is this all just gonna get whipped out from under my feet tomorrow? Like, because it's irrational to think that way. I used to, for sure. I used to think that. But I think your standards and your bar just raises, and now it all becomes relative really for me. Like a real bad thing would have to happen for me to like actually have to fold my business now. Because I've built up like a loyal base and like a loyal following. And
you've expanded the business to obviously apps and things like that as well. Yeah. So like you've invested it in other areas. And I think, and actually I want to ask you this because I know what my opinion is, but do you think going through a prep like the prep for going after your pro card taught you the skills and the mindset and the discipline and the diligence to be able to build a business, a successful business?
Definitely. I mean, it definitely helped. The business was there before that. I was doing like work alongside that, but for sure it helps. Like it builds something different in you. Like, I don't know. I'm not even sure I could put my finger on what it is, but it's just a level of determination and grit. Like it does teach you something about yourself.
There's it's no like doubt showing up every single day. Like for prep, you have to show up every day. And for your business, you have to show up every day.
100%.
And I think people don't understand that. Like you can't go a day without not being on social media for your stories, for sure. You have to have a schedule of posts or know what it is that you're putting out there. And like you say, when you build an audience, you build trust with the audience, and what you put out needs to be in line with who they believe you to be and where you're going moving forward. And I think so many people get lost in social media or become overwhelmed by it or get anxious by it. And ultimately, all you got to do is show up yourself.
Or they just don't start, which is the other thing.
Procrastination.
Yeah. I had this conversation, I think it was I've had it many, many times, but why social media has probably become or has come easier to me is because I've genuinely never tried to be anything that I'm not. I've not tried to portray myself as the perfect bodybuilder. I've not tried to be like a Kuba or an AJ. I've not tried to be like some lifestyle, like flashy, do you know what I mean? Of the car and the watch and all that stuff. Like I just actually just whatever I am at the time, that's what people see.
Authenticity.
And I've been, I don't know why it is. My TikTok at the moment is like riddled with like this authenticity chat about like wavelengths and energies, and apparently authenticity is like the most powerful human energy that comes out of people, so that's interesting. But it's just easy to be yourself. Like, yeah. That's, you know, that is the one thing that you can do better than anyone else, right?
But I think what's hard for people is being authentic means you have to a degree, be vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's something that you have been on social media. Yeah. And it's shown through your YouTube, your journey, your struggles with preps, you know, your relationship with food. You've been very open about speaking about that stuff. And I think that vulnerability is powerful because it's your most authentic self. And I think lots of people are afraid to show that, which is why they're not either successful or, you know, are not seeing the results that they want. But I think that is something that is, should be proud of. And it's something that, you know, you should be continuing to do, because ultimately, if you're showing up as yourself, you've got nothing else to hide. Do you know what I mean?
100%. I think that's one thing that that's always worked in my favor. This is a funny story. When I was a kid, right, I was a compulsive liar. I would get in trouble
after
all the time.
I just told you that.
No, yeah, but no, watch where this is going. I would do something wrong and I would lie about it and I would eventually get found out. So I would lie and lie and lie. Literally, my stepdad used to say, "You're lying through your teeth." And I'd be like, "No, I'm not." Anyway, as I got older and I got into more serious trouble, I then realized this is not a game worth playing anymore. I will get found out every single time. So why don't I just stop lying? So for me, like now as an adult, like honesty and integrity are so important to me. So I will never set an unachievable bar for myself when it comes to honesty or integrity, because like I am just being vulnerable, and I find it easier. Where this weird feeling is, I don't know if you feel this, I'm sure other people definitely do with regards to social media. Like if I do something that, or I'm feeling something within myself that impacts my journey and maybe my followers might be interested in it, I literally feel like an unease if I've not shared it yet.
Yeah.
I feel a genuine unease about like what's going on in my life, and I feel like I need to share. That might just be me. That might be this whole social media thing. I don't know what it is. It's weird. But there's been multiple occasions where I've been like, I've got this this news or something that people might be interested in. I feel like I have to share it.
Mm-hmm. A revelation that you've had, or an experience, like, or something that you've concluded.
Like, whatever it is, like, could be as, you know, something from, I don't know, even from choosing to go from men's physique to classic or whatever that is. Like, for me, there's just this like need to share it now for whatever reason. So, yeah, I've never... And now I'm, and always have been now, super honest with social media. If I'm having struggles with food, I'll tell people. If I'm having struggles with like mental health, I'll tell people. I try not to be like, you know, I'm not saying I share every single struggle that I go through, but like if I deem it important enough for me to share, and probably important enough for someone else to maybe listen to, then I will share it. Like, I'll, you know, after that Finland classic debut, I was literally on my story like crying, and that was not because I wanted, you know, sympathy or anything, and that wasn't acting. I was distraught, and that was a big part of my journey that I share on social media. So I got on and I shared it. Like, it feels like a responsibility to keep people in the know,
especially when somebody had been invested in you for a long time as well,
you know. And you can sit, I can sit here and say, oh, if anyone cares, but like they actually do care, and you'll get told fairly regularly how much people care and how interested they are. Or And maybe if they don't tell you, they will invest in your business, or they'll make a comment, or they'll message you. And quite often, every so often, I will get like a really heartfelt message from someone. I remember when, I'm sure you get it actually from this podcast. That was actually the one, probably the time period where I received so many messages that I was like, oh my God, we're actually making a difference. Like when we did Off the Cuff.
I
miss it so much.
I miss Off the Cuff.
It was like weekly therapy for me, just sitting down with two mates. But yeah, like I remember talking about a lot of stuff on there that people don't talk about or were afraid to talk about. And, you know, going for it, it'd be all sorts of people as well, people that you'd never think to message you. Like, we were just three lads, so I expected our audience to be like, you know, lads, like people that were interested in what we're doing. But we'd get messages from, you know, like older men, younger women, like all different people who were just interested in what we were saying, and it felt like it helped them. So for me, that was like amazing. And again, just an extension of being authentic. Like we spoke about stuff I would never have dreamed of speaking about before on there, you know, stuff that I'd be embarrassed by or felt awkward.
But what it does
by.
Is it makes you relatable. 100%. You know, when you have a social media presence, people put you on a pedestal. As much as you're like, oh, I've only got 30,000, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, someone is looking up to you thinking, I'd love to be in his shoes. 100%. So when you're then showing that vulnerability and you're being authentic, it brings you down to their level. Not that we're at different levels, but it makes you relatable. And it's like, okay, so he's going through hard times too. And oh, he's experiencing the same things that I'm experiencing. Yeah. That makes it normal. I think social media can be a blanket for a lot of things, and it can skew what's going on in people's real lives. You know, it's always the highlight reel. And yeah. actually, I think it's really raw and authentic and good for people to be showing up in that way.
Yeah. And that, I think that's probably also what I do remind myself, because it gives me the ick a little bit when I'm talking about struggles, because I'm always thinking in the back of my head, yeah, but someone's got it worse. So like, what are you moaning about?
Yeah.
But also, some people don't have it worse, or some people are looking at this, I don't know, yeah, highlight reel of my life and thinking everything's great, when it's like, it's not, man. Like, the last year of my life in terms of business has been the most stressful like I've ever had. Like,
perfect time for me to ask you this question. How on earth do you manage work-life balance? Because I know you've talked about that a little bit more before on other podcasts and things like that, but I'm curious to know, like, how do you manage it all? Because it's a lot of work. I know this from personal experience, and I've on a few occasions almost reached burnout from getting too overworked, which is why I'm with One Fit UK. That saved my life a little bit. But talk me through that work-life balance for you.
It's tricky.
Boundaries like now?
I look around like the industry, and I think some people have absolutely zero, but then again, my only depiction of that is their social media, so I don't know. Work-life balance is a really tricky one for me. I can probably epitomize this with a very recent like story. So before coming to Dubai, where it was 12 days ago, 2 weeks ago, we were in Turkey for a couple of weeks, and me and my girlfriend on a holiday, right? And I actually tried to take a week off work. It just doesn't happen. Like, there's no holiday. And actually, we fell out a few times because I'm stressed. Like, I'm actually stressed, like, pretty much 24/7, or some level of, like, ambient anxiety. I don't want to say I've got anxiety, because I don't think I do. I've never had, like, a panic attack or anything that's, like, debilitated me, but there is a level of ambient stress all the time. And since the end of like that last prep, it has just been like growing and growing and growing, and it just sort of continues. So we tried to take time off, like I tried to have a week off, but I've got clients prepping, and there is no time off, I think, in the world of, if you want to be a really good supportive online coach within a prep realm. I actually think within lifestyle, you probably can take a week off if you have a full,
I agree,
you know, a full base of lifestyle clients, or you've set them up to deliver everything that they need and they're self-sufficient. I think you probably can take time off, but for a prep coach, there's no time off. So even though I tried to take a step back from, you know, direct Loom responses or whatever, so I wasn't at the computer, there's still phones buzzing off. And actually, sometimes you just want to like throw it in the pool and like just have it stop going off, just because like you do feel like you need a break. So I can totally relate to that feeling of burnout. I think for me though, the kind of the sacrifice or the benefit is that there is a level of freedom. I remember thinking when I started this, I was like, oh, I'm gonna be able to work from anywhere, like this is gonna be great. But actually, the flip side to that is, again, like another traveling experience, which by the way, traveling is like a big thing for me. It's like one of my other like big passions in life. Early this year, I went to India for 2 weeks for one of my best mates, like 30th birthdays. He's Indian, he wanted us all to go. I was at the airport working while they were all like on the beers and Weatherspoons. So I was like, I can go. And there was never a minute for me where I was like, I can't go. I don't need to ask anyone for holiday. I don't need to ask if I can have time off. You know, I can clear my schedule and I can go somewhere, but I still need to be at my laptop. So you're not actually like free. And then what about posting? Like, yeah. I don't know about you, but if I'm away for a gym for a week, I've really struggled to post content because I feel like I'm not being that person or whatever. So again, I sort of mentioned earlier about setting like unachievable bars for myself, but one of them that obviously I've set is, you know, a bodybuilder and training, and therefore my content is largely based around that. I'd feel weird doing a whole week of, you know, content lifestyle that's not around bodybuilding, you know, something to do with that. So it does become difficult. And you know, I think the benefit is absolutely that you can go away and you can work from anywhere, but that's the bottom line, like you're still working. So work-life balance is a tricky one. In terms of boundaries, I think that,
do you have like a shut off time with clients when they're messaging, or are you like me, like international, so you've got global clients and you have to mentally decide when you're going to stop answering WhatsApp messages?
So one of the early things I did, and it was probably the best thing I did, was get another phone. So I don't know if you've got a work phone and a business phone.
I just have one phone.
So I had I got a work phone and a personal one and a work one, but I had an Apple Watch, which I can see you've got on, and
I turn notifications off.
Okay, so I hadn't worked that out at this time. And I remember it was in lockdown, so when things were getting busy and I was just sort of being exposed to it, I literally went for a walk to get some downtime and my watch was just going buzz, and I was like, oh my fucking God, I've got to get a different phone. So I did that pretty quickly. So that was quite big for me. I think in terms of like the actual downtime, my replies would be slower when I'm training, mm-hmm. because that is actually my time. Like, I really want to just lock into my session and get it done. That's the time when I do feel that it truly is like therapy for me. That is my time, yeah, when I'm
agreed.
In like flow state or whatever, and I'm not focused, so my work phone will go away. And I'll probably be filming my sets anyway, but that's not stressful for me. That's fine. And then in the evening, yeah, definitely. Like I really do feel like I need like just a couple hours before bed. Like I probably, when I sit down for my evening meal, that's the time when I'll probably stop replying. Yeah. But the bottom line is I've been up since six, working since 6:30. Mm-hmm. So my day is like 12 hours of, you know, on off work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I try and have a couple hours before bed. And clients may not get a response in that time, but the clients that need urgent responses, like for now, ones that are like on prep or whatever, I just give them my personal number. So if they do need to, and to be fair, they're pretty respectful with it. I must give them credit for that. But I understand my role here. Like I'm here, and I wouldn't want any different for myself. So I've got to support them in
that finding
that
balance
time.
Of you've got the freedom to be able to work and live wherever you want, but you've also got to understand that
exactly.
You know, it's very hard to switch off.
Yeah.
It's very hard to switch off. But like you said, I would say with most clients, if you were to say, I'm going to take 2 or 3 days off or whatever, bar prep clients, because I've done that. I went to Zanzibar for 5 days just like on my own. But the only people I spoke to were the girls that were on prep.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else understood and they gave me that time off. But even then, I feel anxiety when I'm not working.
Yes. And that's like the
underlying anxiety that's always buzzing. It's like, you should be doing something.
And also, I think like with how the industry is now, with how packed and competitive it is, like, 7 days off, I just feel like I'm falling behind. And that's the same feeling I get with my physique as well. Like,
and it's the same with training. I don't think I could take more than 3 days off training.
No.
Like, unless, it really hard.
You know, unless it's a planned in deload. And this is probably why I was pretty stressed when we went away, because we went away, I couldn't find a gym that I particularly liked or wanted to train in. But I'd sort of let her book it and whatever. That was her thing. But annoyingly, literally 2 weeks before I'd taken like a planned deload, well, not a planned, an unplanned one, I was like pretty fucked. I was like, I need a week off. If that, you know, if I'd have been able to push that on for 2 more weeks and then had it while I was away, I wouldn't have been so stressed about it. But I was annoyed because I'd sort of had that week and then I'd had another 10 days where my training wasn't optimal. So that was difficult. But yeah, work-life balance. I can't say it exists, if I'm honest. Like,
still trying.
But I'm okay with that. Like, I know these are the years for me to like hustle and work hard, or, you know, do what I need to do. And I say this all the time, like, this is the life I chose. I could have stayed at John Lewis. You know, if I wanted my 25 annual leave days a year, I could have stayed at John Lewis.
It's true. And it's a bit like what we say to our prep clients when they're finding it hard on prep. You're choosing to prep.
Yeah.
It's a choice you're making. So you have to accept the consequences and just work through it and find that balance when,
like,
you can.
What's the alternative? I can quit. I can stay. I can tell everyone tomorrow, if I've had enough, I'm stopping online coaching.
Yeah.
I can literally do that tomorrow. But like, I couldn't think of anything worse. So, you know, that's actually always what I used to do. That was a mindset that I adopted on prep. You know, when it was really hard, and in that prep in particular, when things are difficult, you know, I just asked myself, like you say, this is a choice. You can stop tomorrow. Do you want to do that? Couldn't think of anything worse. Right, carry on then.
Yeah.
And that's a very quick conversation to have with yourself.
I think we're almost out of time, unfortunately.
I blame
you because you were late.
Yeah. 1 minute.
But I just want to ask you, I don't have time to even ask the Q&A questions. Maybe we could do that as a subtext, but there were some questions that came through on my Instagram. Actually some really good ones. But I'm just going to ask you one simple question. What's next for Joe Brightman?
That's an easy one. I can answer that one. So there's the in terms of physique, the goal would be to compete again, like one more time. Like, I definitely want to do one more, just to what I said earlier, kind of look back on. I want to do a prep and just be super happy with how it went. I want to end it and go, we did everything I could, that was the best me. You know, and where the chips fall, like, that's
right,
fine.
The comeback, yes.
I guess this one is a comeback because it did go away. Business-wise, coaching obviously continues. I'm working with OneFit as well, which is really exciting. That's really cool. And hopefully something that we can keep pushing forward. I think it's a big... I think I've said that last week. If I was a coach that had somewhere between 10 to 50 clients, most of them were lifestyle, I would literally be switching over to OneFit tomorrow.
Immediately.
Like prep, there's, again, full authenticity, there's some work to do. Like, it needs peak week functionality. There's certain things it doesn't have yet, But if my majority of my client base was lifestyle, I'd be moving over to it tomorrow. Mm. And then obviously with my coaching, that actually is something, a launch, like something exciting that's coming up, which I won't speak about yet because it's not fully in the works, but I'm excited, man. It's going to be something new, a slightly different direction for like Team Brightman or whatever that is.
Okay.
So we'll keep the lid on that, but yeah.
Well, then we'll have to get you back on when you move to Dubai as well.
We can talk again. Yeah, we can talk again.
Are we moving to Dubai? Can we tell?
Yeah, yeah, we are. Yeah, that's the other thing.
That's also there as well. Okay, sick. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Joe. It's been a pleasure to have you here. I appreciate it. I know it's a late podcast. We're actually recording this at like 7:30 till 8:30. But no, it's been lovely to have you on, and I'm looking forward to another one in the future.
Yes, for sure. Thanks, Bex. Appreciate it.
Thank you.